Case 24 of the Denko Roku, Transmission of Light. Sonja said, I want to search for the way. How should I use my mind? 23rd Patriarch said, if you wish to search for the way, you should not use your mind. Sonja said, if I do not use my mind, who would perform Buddha's deeds? 23rd Patriarch said, if you use your mind, that would not be a virtuous deed. When you do not use your mind, that is Buddha's deed. It is said in the Dhamma Sutra, virtuous deeds are virtuous because there is no I and my place in them. Please sit comfortably. So the student here is asking about how should I practice? How should I use my mind to search for the way, so search for the truth? How should I direct myself? And this is the baseline question of all good students. The 23rd Patriarch is saying, if you use your mind to figure it out, if you use your mind to orchestrate events, or to make something happen, that is not virtuous. And not the action of Buddha, because it still has some attachment in there. The I, the ego, is doing then these wholesome deeds, or attached to the outcome of the wholesome deeds. Master Wu Men, in the commentary on the first case in the Wu Men Khan, echoes this same point in the Gateless Barrier of in the Koan Mu. For subtle realization, it is of the utmost importance that you cut off the mind road. If you do not pass the barrier of the ancestors, if you do not cut off the mind road, then you are a ghost clinging to bushes and grasses. We become ghosts when you are seduced by your delightful, elegant stories or hurtful stories or stories about not being good enough. The way to realize your own Buddha nature is to stop, to be still, to pause, to breathe. Don't try to figure it out intellectually. We had a lovely inquiry yesterday with Melissa, inquiring into that part of her, that dominant, strong part of the mind that wants to figure it out. We have all kinds of ideas in about practice. And this can get us so far down the track. It gets us a long way down the track. But at the end of the day, the mind cannot figure out that which is vast and immeasurable, because the mind is limited. How can that which is limited recognize that which is limitless? So what to do? Such a dilemma. Just focus on your koan. Everything gets absorbed then into mu. Your fantasies, your plans, your doubts, sensations, everything gets absorbed into the koan. Then mu breathes mu. The whole universe breathes mu. And mu translates here as no thing, nothing. So just sit in that broad daylight of your intrinsically pure awareness, letting each precious moment unfold just as it is. In case 19 of the Mumankam, we also have a similar resonance here. In the ordinary mind is the Tao. Zhao Zhou, great master Zhao Zhou, this is when he was still a student and he was with his master, his great teacher, Nan Chuan. So Zhao Zhou asked Nan Chuan, what is the Tao? And Nan Chuan said, ordinary mind is the Tao. Zhao Zhou asks Nan Chuan, should I try to direct myself towards the Tao or not? Should I do that, or should I try to do something about, getting awakened and try to use my mind or not? Nan Chuan said, well, if you try to direct yourself, you betray your own practice. Zhao Zhou asked, but how can I know the Tao if I don't direct myself? that fundamental dilemma again. Nan Chuan said, the Tao is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine Tao, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can this be discussed at the level of affirmation or negation? And in the Denku Roku, in case 31, there's another variation on this theme. Similar question from the student. And the teacher uses the sharp sword to cut to the chase. Dai Zenji asks Kanchi Daishi, please teach me the way of emancipation. The patriarch said, who is binding you? Dai Zenji said, no one is binding me. The patriarch then said, then why should you search for emancipation? Implying, in that very search, it's right there all along. So if there's no one binding you, then why should you search for emancipation? So back here in this case, case 24, Sonja said, well, if I do not use my mind, who would perform Buddha's deeds? Sonja's here has an attachment, a clinging, an identification with his mind and his actions. For Sonja, his mind and Buddha's deeds are synonymous. Yeah? The I, the sense of I, is clinging to the doer, that part of us that is the sense of action and the doing. And so when we're clinging to our actions and results or outcome, or have investment in our actions and our deeds, then the sense of I, the ego, clings to that. But what are Buddha's deeds? Eiken Roshi says that Buddha's deeds are expressed in the four great vows that we chant every day. And these vows are deep aspirations. They encapsulate the path of the Bodhisattva and the Bodhicitta, which is the aspiration for personal and universal liberation. And so we don't just sit here for our own freedom and well-being and liberation, but we sit here for all beings. An aspiration is considered to be the eighth paramita, and the seventh paramita is bala, which is vows, which we heard a lovely expression of the aspiration and vows yesterday from Kathleen in the inquiry session. So these are deep paramitas. Yeah? So the four great vows remind us of what our true work is, the deeds of Buddha. The great vows are an expression of the awakened heart-mind. Yet they, in some ways, are impossible tasks. Even though we are imperfect beings, we vow to walk the path of perfection and actualize our fullest potential as a human being, which in the Buddhist world means to commit ourselves to waking up and to living a life of awakening. Some students feel daunted by the impossible nature of these tasks and these vows rather than feel inspired. Although we say, though the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The I in this vow, this intentional I, is not a permanent, solid entity. One might say, well, if the I is an illusion, how can I undertake anything? It's a kind of double bind, isn't it? In an ultimate sense, the I cannot save anyone, not even itself. In fact, the I just digs a deeper grave for itself. As long as you are thinking, it is me, my small personal ego, I have to save all beings, then it is an obstacle and it is a limitation, and the vow limits the vows to being just ordinary vows rather than great vows. Virtuous deeds are virtuous because there is no I and my place in them. There's no clinging and attachment to these deeds. So even a small action can become Buddha deeds. Chopping wood, cooking the meal, serving the food, ringing the bell, cleaning the bathrooms. In order for these vows to become great vows, Eiken Roshi suggests that we turn the first vow into a daily life koan by asking, well, how can I save the many beings? What does this really mean? Carry the question with you like a koan. Let it govern all your words and deeds. Can we put our palms together with a different attitude? Not I vowing, but giving yourself up to the vow. Let the vow carry you. Let the vow fill you wholeheartedly. If we take this wholehearted attitude into everything we are doing here in session, then the thought of I starts to drop away. It softens. It doesn't become so central stage all the time. So let the I and the my and the me sort of soften and just chop the wood, just chop the vegetables, just clean the room, just wash the body, just walk out in this beautiful place. Then in that act, in joining with that act wholeheartedly, then there is a true intimacy, oneness and harmony with all beings. You are not separate from all beings. Then this vow is actualized as a great vow of liberation in your own heart and mind. And the purity of the moment, each thing just keeps bubbling up, the perennial nature of who we are. And the past so clearly shows us the way of the way out of the illusion of I, me, my story. A way out of the loneliness and separation and fear of death. Only the I can fear. And the I, in some sense, this sense of I, is actually, at a very subtle level, energetically, it is fear. That's what the I is. It's a sense of clinging. Clinging to something in the world of form. And that's all it is. And when you see into that and you release the clinging, the sense of I starts to dissolve. And when the I starts to dissolve, then there's no fear. And when there's no fear, there's no division between oneself and other. When the ego shell is cracked open, the wonderful warmth of the human heart is released. There's no division then between what divides me and you. There's a lovely story here that I'd like to share with you about one of the first female Zen masters in Japan. Her name was Mugai Nyodai. And she was born as Chai Ono in 1223, and she lived to 1298. And Chai Ono came from a samurai family, and women from a samurai background were allowed to enter temples and go up to the head priest and chat to them and have a discourse and have tea with them. So she took advantage of this privilege, and she visited a whole lot of Zen temples. And Wu Sui Tzu Yan was a Chinese priest who was brought over from China to be abbot of Engakuji in the year 1200. At that time, there wasn't many Japanese masters, and so they brought over the Chinese master and installed him as the abbot. And so when Chi Yono entered the temple, Wu Sui offered her tea. And so her question to all these Zen masters was, what is Zen? Great question. What is it? So she asked this question as she was sipping tea. He offered her tea. Chi Yono asked this question at every Zen temple, to every priest. And Wu Sui answered, Zen is the heart of the one who asks. It is not someone else's words. It's a lovely response, isn't it? Zen is the heart of someone who asks that question. And she smiled. And then she said, she was quite challenging, this woman. She, so why does the teacher give sermons that are recorded? Wu Sui smiled back. And he said, with a deaf man, you should show him the moon by pointing. With a blind man, you should show him the gate by knocking on it. And after a long pause, he then added, when I was awakened, it was like a bird escaping a cage. And so Chiano liked this response from the teacher. And she visited Wu Sui again and again. And she was an unusual sight in the monastery, with her layers of fine clothing and kimonos, her hair piled up and groomed, and you can imagine sort of in a Zen monastery that was rather a kind of odd sight. And after some time of visiting the monastery and talking and having tea with the teacher, she decided to dismiss her maid. She came from a wealthy samurai family, cut off her hair, shaved her head, and arrived in a plain under robe. And then she took ordination and she became Mugai Nyodai. And her duties in the monastery were bucket duties. And she had to, it was quite a large monastery, and so her job and task every day, several times a day, was to take the buckets down to the stream, fill them up with water, and carry the buckets back to the kitchen to the cook. And so she would have to do that this many, many times a day. That was her task, her main task, and she did it every single day for years. In the evenings, she had tea with her teacher. One night, while they were having tea together, and they heard the deer in the forest making a kind of rustling sound, and Wu Sui said to her, "Where is the deer? Do you know who hears?" Then he shouted a deep, inarticulate roar that seemed to pierce Nyodai's heart, and she fell into a deep reflection. The next day, she took up her bucket and walked to the stream. And seeing the moon reflected in the water, she thought, "Is this the same moon, or a different moon, or no moon at all?" She looked around her with the familiar woods, and she saw the icy glow of the moonlight shining equally on everything, the whole moon reflected in a single dewdrop hanging on a leaf. Yeah. Beautiful. And she carried the water back, gave it to the cook, bowed, and then went to her room, and she wrote her first poem. And there was a practice in the many, many generations in the Zen tradition, if you had any sort of insight, you were asked to write a poem, a verse. And some students have done this here, just naturally, voluntarily, have written a verse, their own poem, after koans, studying koans. So this is her first verse. "The bucket took the stream water and held it, and the reflection of the moon through the pines lodged there in purity." So here in this image, this beautiful image, this was a lovely image of the stillness of mind. Yeah? Purity of the moon reflecting in the water. So the mind had become quiet. She was not using her mind to figure it out. Yeah. And the teacher said, "Well, that's a good beginning." And told her to study the Heart Sutra. So one day when she was scooping up water into her bucket in the stream, because every day she would also have to quite often repair her bucket, you know, these old buckets, and they were strapped together with string and they needed to be lined with bamboo leaves. So one day when she was scooping up the water in the bucket, the bottom fell out of the bucket, literally. And even though she had repaired it with bamboo leaves, the whole bottom fell out. Gone at once was all that had bound her small ego self. Without a bottom, a bucket is no longer a bucket anymore. Without a boundary of the ego, the self is no more separate from the world than the drop of rain is separate from the ocean. And Nyodai's water spilled over the ground and it disappeared into the soil and melted into the grass, invisible and vast. Who hears the deer? Who carries the water? Who grieves? Who learns? So she then went back to her room. She wrote another poem. This is her second poem. So many ways I fixed the bucket. Its braces weak and soon to break, until one day the bottom fell out. Then there was no water in the bucket, no moon shining in the water. And so here the bucket is an analogy for the self, the container for the self. So many ways I fixed the bucket. Isn't that familiar? That we try to fix our bucket up every day, patch it up, strap it up, have lots of images of our bucket, you know, that we're attached to. Sometimes they're nice buckets, sometimes they're not so nice. Sometimes they've got lots of holes in them. Oh. So we love this bucket though, don't we? Yeah. And it's very practical and wonderful thing. But we need to see through, you know, the bottom needs to fall out of the bucket. To open up to the great way of who we are. So she reported this poem to her teacher, and this time, yeah, a second poem. He then checked her and asked her lots of checking questions, lots of koans, and she was able to answer them very, very clearly. So for a few days, she just sat in that wonderful, spaced-out honeymoon phase of enlightenment. bathing in her understanding and that beautiful open mind and vast and fathomless and just ordinary as it is. And she did not care about anything and did not care about her duties either. And the teacher left her alone and told the monks to leave her alone. And so she was wandering around the gardens and could just sit there and fall into a flower and just kind of bathe in the flowerness and the stream and, you know, each and everything. It's kind of when that mind falls open, we fall open into each and everything, and each and everything becomes us and takes us away and fills our being. And so it's shining and beautiful then. Yeah. So everything was disappearing into that ground, yeah. The water, time, space. Yeah, flowers. So after tea, And after a few days of her bathing in that lovely open space of mind, then she went back to carrying water, back to her duties. It's just like before enlightenment, carrying water, after enlightenment, carrying water. Yeah, but the second time, there's something different about, same task, but what's different? There is a difference. So virtuous deeds of Buddha are virtuous because there is no I and me. The burden of the self is put down. The bottom of the bucket is fallen out. Yeah. So after tea one day, Wu Sui gave her a priest's robe, a gold brocade priest's robe, a set of bowls and a picture of himself. And she became the first female Zen master in Japan. And she went off and established, after some years, she went off and established her own hermitage. And eventually, Keiji, which was the name of her hermitage that she established, became the head temple of the female five mountain system of the Rinzai monasteries. I didn't even know that existed until I read this story, but apparently so. So Mugai Nyodai's poems became teaching koans, and the story of the bucket with no bottom became famous throughout all of Zen. So how do we practice the deeds of Buddha? Yeah. Just walking, just sitting, just serving, just cooking, just drinking your tea. Yeah. full and complete, each and everything. Every activity, if you just give yourself fully to that activity, yeah, then every action becomes the virtuous action of Buddha. And we enact the great vows right here in these simple, ordinary deeds and tasks of our daily life. So please enjoy these wonderful little tasks. Let the bottom fall out of your own bucket, so you can enter the great way.